Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of today's Football Times with me, Aidan Williams. We've got another hard-hitting set of topics to get through this time, with my best laid plans for the pod changing given the recent events up at St. James's Park. We finally get to dedicate a fair amount of time to of a podcast to Newcastle United, but not quite in the circumstances I might have hoped. As well as Saudi wealth funds, time permitting, we'll also delve into Arsene Wenger's plans for world domination and biennial World Cups. We'll see how that goes. So to discuss it all with me today, three of my regular compadres on this pod, Paul McParlin, welcome. Good evening.
Good evening, Aidan. Thanks for having me on the show. And looking forward to exploring your moral compass during our discussions this evening.
I know. I feel like I might be on trial a little bit here, but we'll see how it goes. And Matthew Gibbs, good evening to you.
Hello. Thanks for having us back on. Yeah, it's going to be a heavy one, I think.
That's what we do. That's what we do sometimes, and we have to delve into it. Circumstances dictate in this time, I'm sure. And Stephen Scragg, last but not least, how are you doing, Stephen?
Oh, we're very well, thanks, Aidan. And yes, thanks for the invite. I'm looking forward to this one tonight. That sounded ominous there. That sounded kind of like, oh, it's rolling up the sleeves, and we're all getting ready to give Aidan some Chinese burns.
Yes, exactly. Well, let's get into it then. So the Saudi Private Investment Fund, along with a couple of other junior partners in the deal, Amanda Staveley and the Rubin brothers, completed their takeover of Newcastle United a couple of days ago as we record, after a whirlwind 48 hours that saw the long-mooted deal go from being stuck in upcoming court cases and potential arbitration all the way to a sudden completion. The Mike Ashley era is over, but it's out of the frying pan and into the fire somewhat as far as Newcastle are concerned. So firstly, before we delve more deeply into some of the many aspects around it all, I just want to get your first reactions, I guess, to the news. I'll come on to mine in due course, but what was your first reaction? Because obviously this isn't quite like any other takeover, at least. Well, some parallels, I guess, in others that have happened in recent years, but no, this is on a whole different level. So your reactions, I guess, to the news and what your first thoughts were on it. Paul, how about you?
Yeah, it was kind of a mixed reaction, really, Aidan, because, I mean, as a football fan, part of me is actually, you know, quite pleased to see that Mike Ashley has finally renounced his control of Newcastle, because obviously you have not for long. Yeah, you know, you have nothing but sympathy for, you know, for the turmoil and the lack of direction the club has shown for a number of years now, where, you know, where success on the field just doesn't seem to be a realistic possibility, and a series of disastrous managerial appointments, and, you know, and with the present incumbents, Steve Bruce, who I think most Newcastle fans are sincerely hoping hasn't persuaded the Saudi consortium to keep him on. I think on the other hand, and I think undoubtedly, you know, you can't avoid it from the press coverage. There are certain moral implications, but, you know, I don't think Newcastle are the only club in this situation. And I think, you know, it's not just Newcastle. I mean, as a society, I think we need to examine on our ongoing relations with arms trade deals with Saudi Arabia, the financial investment the Saudis have in the country. So I'm not going to sit here and say it's outrageous. Newcastle, the takeover shouldn't be allowed to go ahead, because quite clearly, I'd be a bit of a hypocrite if I said that, bearing in mind the country that I live in at the moment. I think one thing is that it wouldn't be helpful if the Premier League would be a bit more forthcoming and in their reasons for allowing the takeover to go ahead, because, you know, part of you can't help but think there's a suspicion that was it all down to those TV piracy issues? Is that why the deal is now going ahead? I'm not quite sure. So, and certainly, I don't know about you, Aidan, but I still have no idea what you have to pass to be a fit and proper person. Because I don't even know what that criteria is, whether that's in the public domain or not. I don't know, is a committee decides who the fit and proper persons are? What kind of evidence do you have to show? I'm really quite I find that quite frustrating because I think clarity in a situation like this is absolutely essential. And I found a quote from a comedian called Mark Steele, who I'm not too familiar with, but I was just reading to you. He just said, if ISIS had been smart, instead of blowing stuff up, they'd have bought some football clubs. That way, most of the people in this country would have held them as heroes. And I think that I kind of guess where he's coming from with that quote.
Yes, yes, exactly. I mean, a lot seems to get brushed aside when the potential for a bit of success is dangled in front of you. Interesting points there, and we'll end up picking up on many of them. I think the Ashley era going and Premier League and piracy and so on. Absolutely right. Matthew, how about you? Your first reaction?
I think it is one of those situations, one of those cases where there's basically no positives. Anything, and even where the positives that can come out of a deal like this, where PIF could invest in the local area of Newcastle, they could regenerate St James's Park, build a world-beating team like World Conquerors, that's still a negative because it's sports washing at its most basic. And yeah, it's difficult. I think it's really unfair on Newcastle fans to be put in this position because it's just more proof that fans have no say in football whatsoever. Because whether Newcastle fans were for or against the deal or have any particular feelings about, you know, I don't want my club to be run by this kind of regime, it's kind of irrelevant because it went ahead anyway. There was no say in it whatsoever. There was no, there's no question. There was no consulting of the fans to say, do you want this sort of thing to go ahead? There was just, it happened and you kind of have to deal with the consequences. You have to decide whether, it's horrible that Newcastle fans are being put in this, you know, situation where they have to kind of decide if they want to attach themselves to this type of regime. I think it's just it's a really sad day, and it's really, really poor reflection of the Premier League and football in this country, where everything is so greedy. It's just, it's built on greed, and it's all about being bigger and better each year. And it's just about how can we get more money than last year? And this decision is, it's built on greed. It's the sort of natural end game, I guess, of what Rupert Murdoch and everyone in 1992 dreamt of when they, you know, first put the Premier League into action. And it's I think it's really sad.
But you're right, it goes far beyond football. I think of the state of the nation in many ways, of courting such wealth and greed and not really caring where it comes from. That's another thing we will get into in due course. And Stephen, how about you?
A bit like Paul, you know, it's a two-sided coin there. You know, there's a lot of hypocrisy, not just in football, but, you know, across the board. You know, I think it was David Conn, might be wrong about that, but someone posted on Twitter, I think it was yesterday or earlier today, about, you know, Boris Johnson's, you know, attempt to put on a cape and, you know, take, you know, some kind of credit for the downing of the projected Super League, but is, you know, stony silent about the concept of Saudi Arabia having some kind of stake within one of what is English football's most traditional, you know, institutions. You know, they're a proud historical institution. You know, this is very much a, it's not even a two-sided coin. This is the most multifaceted coin going, really. You know, and when it comes down to it, you know, it's even kind of like down to, you know, not taking football fans into consideration. But that's a very, very homogenized kind of concept to start with. You know, not all football fans are cut from the same cloth. Not all football fans want the same thing. You know, under the umbrella of one football club alone, you know, you only have to look back at, you know, relatively recently, well, end of last season when Manchester United fans stormed Old Trafford. You know, a lot of placards, a lot of banners outside the ground, and, you know, from you know, some right-minded messages, you know, others were kind of like, you know, Glazers out, Gazprom in. You know, some of the, you know, from football supporters and football across the spectrum, you know, the messages are going to be myriad. You know, there is not one homogenized, not one united, you know, approach to football fandom and the whole lot of it. You know, I, within this as well, you know, the Newcastle fans are left in some kind of no-win situation. You know, you've got plenty who are delighted. And those are delighted, probably, I say either don't care is probably the wrong expression, but don't understand the connotations. You know, within that, you're already getting sounding out of some turning around and saying a lot of the negativity that is coming towards this from other supporters and other elements is anti-Newcastle, that people somehow hate Newcastle, and that's not the case. Yes, Sunderland fans clearly probably do, and I think we know that, but I think across the board, I don't think kind of like, you know, Newcastle aren't a disliked football club. I think most people would be quite delighted to see Newcastle come good and to win the lottery, to for the six numbers to come up for them, just somewhere else maybe. You know, from a completely different direction. You know, would be infinitely better for them.
Yeah, you're right on the sort of fandom. There's a wide spectrum of views, of course, and you know, places like Twitter aren't the best forum to gauge the overall reaction to such events. There is a wide spectrum of views across the board in Newcastle fans, but I think overall, the reaction is largely positive. And I think a lot of the reasons you're talking about there, Stephen, of ignorance, lack of understanding, or in some cases, willful disregard and not wanting to look at the bigger picture as well, comes into it. There is also a lot of conflict. But coming into that, of course, is what's gone before. Now, obviously, it pales into significance compared to the Saudi regime, but the frustration of the Ashley years, they can't be understated in terms of the Newcastle fan base. And I think that explains some of the reaction to this, although obviously that isn't a reaction that's fully taking into account who the new owners are. You know, the Ashley regime, it's been an awful one for Newcastle, as you guys have alluded to. And the club basically lurched from one self-inflicted disaster to another. You know, you had the things like the constructive dismissal of Kevin Keegan way back in the early days of it. You had Joe Kinnear repeatedly, stadium name, the appalling treatment of Jonas Gutierrez when he was away dealing with his cancer treatment. I could go on and on. There's been so many cases, but, you know, that does pale into insignificance now. But I think at first, and I definitely felt, I must admit, I felt a bit of this myself when the news was coming through. There was undoubtedly a bit of joy that the Mike Ashley era was over. That was one of my initial reactions, absolutely. Another of my initial reactions that came along soon after that was, crikey, this suddenly makes Newcastle one of the richest clubs in the world. And that felt really, really uncomfortable on a number of fronts. One of which, obviously, is where this money has come from. But equally, there was also the feeling that this doesn't feel quite right for our place. You know, I've only ever known Newcastle be well below that, other than for a very brief spell in the sort of mid to late 90s, where Newcastle could compete. I've never known anything other than Newcastle being well below the elite. And it just suddenly feels weird to think that there is the prospect of Newcastle going up to that level. Do I feel comfortable with it, though? No, I don't. And that's where this conflict comes. I do feel a little bit like I have like an angel and devil, one on each shoulder here, because it's one is obviously horrified at the repeated lust for money that isn't just football, but football has most definitely become at the top level. And that's something that's turned me off for a long time. That isn't just a reaction to this. Horrified too at this particular owner. I'd probably find it easier to moralize if it wasn't my club, that if I'm being honest. And I think that is something that is hard to sort of work through. And that's where I've had, you know, a few days to lull on it, and my sort of thoughts are hardening more aghast at it all than they were initially, perhaps. That's not to say my reaction was wholly positive at the beginning. It certainly wasn't. But, you know, the more you ponder on it, the worse it gets. And that doesn't feel fair or right, but that's just the way it is. And yes, I have on my other shoulder, there's something telling me to be happy that Mike Ashley's gone and that Newcastle may compete. But you know, it's not really the way you want it to be. I do think it is, Matthew mentioned it, the end game of what has been happening. You know, there's been a succession of takeovers of various big clubs over the years, each seemingly building on what went before in terms of the levels it can be pushed to, perhaps. You think back now of Abramovich and Russian gas money and exploitation and think, well, that's small fry compared to the Saudi state. But, you know, that one happened and it got waved through. And then Manchester City happened and gets taken over by a state as well, or an emirate in their case. And that gets waved through. No problem. It's more money. There's the way the Glazers funded their deal for Manchester United and how that's all worked out. You've got this sort of American-owned push for the Super League and so on from those particular sets of owners and how that was received. Sure, that got fought against for now. And now you've got this. And it seems like each is another step up the ladder towards doom and whatever comes next. I have no idea whether it all comes crashing around. There's a bit of me that thinks this is Newcastle. It can't possibly just turn out the way Man City's takeover has, and that they'll end up playing beautiful football and winning all sorts of trophies. There's a little bit of me thinks, well, that still won't happen because this is Newcastle and it won't turn out like that. And the whole edifice will come tumbling down before that happens. I am deeply in conflict, though, and this is something I want to get into, is as fans of a club, I think it's easy to moralise when it isn't yours. I think there is a number of people in Newcastle support who may well walk away because of this. There's a number of people who have walked away over the years, but I think the vast majority will support it because it's a football team doing better. And to me, this is Newcastle in this position, nobody else, but I do suspect that would largely be the same no matter what club it was, because we're all conditioned that way. Well, not all of us, but, you know, the majority are conditioned that way to see wealth and greed as the only way to success or to enhance yourself in football, which is a sorry state of affairs. So I kind of want to think a little bit now from fans' perspective of would people or should people walk away in this situation? Should there be wider protests about the regime? Should any of this come from within Newcastle, or should it all be the outside pressure on Newcastle? I'm kind of interested in your thoughts on that kind of aspect, Paul.
Well, I mean, I think you've articulated the dilemma that faces most right-thinking Newcastle fans perfectly there, Aidan, because, you know, although it's easy to jump in and criticise as a supporter of a club that's not Newcastle, you know, I think as a fan, you always ask yourself the question, if this, like Farag was saying, if this takeover had happened at Everton and all this money would be coming in, then I would be exactly like you, part of me would be like, great, you know, it's a chance to get ourselves back to where we think we should be as a football club. But on the other hand, part of you think, yeah, but do we really want to go down this route? Is this the way it has to progress in football now? And I think kind of in Newcastle's defence, you know, you could take the viewpoint that the financial football has changed so much in this century, and it's more and more about a super rich elite group of state owners, industrial businessmen who are controlling world football. And I think increasingly I can see a situation in, say, 15 years' time where three-quarters of the Premier League are owned by, you know, different country states across the world. You know, Matthew mentioned football, the lust for greed in the Premier League. You know, you can see North Korea buying a team, being welcomed with open arms in within the next 20 years or so. But yeah, I think as both Matthew and Stephen say, it is all about money. And it's that dilemma. As a football fan, you want success. And then, I think, as you've outlined really well today, there's like a divine line where at what price do you want success? At what price, what are you prepared to accept and tolerate if it means your team gets success? And although we have this debate now amongst the four of us here, I'm always really conscious of the generational shift. So, you know, as someone like me who grew up on the old style First Division, you know, I've always struggled to adapt to the Premier League. But for my son's generation, all they've known is the Premier League and Champions League. So to them, that is the norm. They have no concept what went on before. So 10, 15 years' time, you know, when your children are growing up and they're in their 20s, they might not have the same view about ownership as what we have. They might just see it as the norm that a state comes in and buys a club. So I also think there's a kind of element of future-proofing acceptability of buying football clubs here as well, because it's not just about the present day. They haven't bought Newcastle just for a short-term game. They've bought it to embed themselves into the culture of football society and to gain the element of respectability. I think Matthew used to say sports washing before, an element of respectability that they couldn't get by any other means. And when you kind of look at both the Saudi plans, what the Saudi plans were for the expand the World Club Championship and expand the World Nations League. It's all part of what, you know, getting a foothold into the Premier League, which is the major generation of money. So I actually feel huge sympathy for you, Aidan, because I would feel exactly the same. I'd be delighted at the prospect of success coming my team's way. But I'd also have some concerns about how that success is coming about. And it just raised all sorts of wide issues that I think Steve was just upon before about, you know, football fans being cut from different elements of the same cloth. But, you know, are we now totally away from a situation where football fans have any saying they're going to give a Premier League club? Are those days gone? Has the fan movement hit peak? Is it just being absolutely wiped out by money? And that concerns me more than the ownership issue.
Yeah, some great points there. It is, yeah, it's a toughie. And Matthew, I'm sure you've got some strong views on this one.
Yeah, I think like as Ball alluded to, there are many strands to this takeover, and basically all of them are unfair to Newcastle fans because like they're being used as political pawns in international relations of like on the biggest scale. Like we know that there was a really good write up of this in the Financial Times, which sort of went through in detail different parts of the process, and they sort of delved into how Mohammed bin Salman, the head of the Saudi Arabia government, also head of PIF, the company who've just taken over Newcastle, texted Boris Johnson personally to try and push through the deal. Now, I know the PIF are claiming that there is no involvement from the Saudi government into the takeover of Newcastle, but the fact that we know that for a fact kind of dispels any myth around that. So therefore, you kind of have to, like, as a fan, like, personally, like, I know this is a lot of, like, conjecture because I know the reality, like you said, you can moralise this better when it's not your club. So if this was Birmingham City, the club I support, I kind of have to think about how I would react then. And I know the reality of that would be different to, you know, what I'm now going to say. But I kind of, I'm going to quote Arrigo Sacchi now by saying, like, football is the most important things of the unimportant things in life. So I kind of have to think about how the football I'm watching and enjoying is coming into being and how that money is financed and how, I think it's quite easy to forget that football is such a global sport that what happens to a club in Newcastle does have wide ranging effects on other people. So Adam Crafton, who is a journalist for The Athletic, he did quite an interesting thread about how he, as a gay man, feels about Saudi Arabia taking over a club. And it wasn't positive. It didn't make him feel any more welcome in a football stadium. And like, obviously football has inherent problems already with homophobia and welcoming LGBTQ plus people into the sport. So it's not a positive thing. Same again for, I'm going to say her name wrong, I apologize, Hatice Cengiz, who's the fiance of Kamal Khashoggi, who, I mean, I think everyone knows the journalist murdered by all accounts by the Saudi government, talking about how this damages like her calls for justice, other people's calls for justice. So it's like I said earlier, I feel that there's just it's one of those cases where every positive is actually a negative because it's all sports washing. It's all about making this regime more palatable to the outside world. They can point to Newcastle and say, "Hey, we're not all bad. Look, we've done good stuff with this. We've got a well-beaten squad." So I think it's horrible. I think it's a really difficult situation for fans to be put into. And if it was my team, I would definitely think about walking away. And I mean, the base element, as we've touched on, I with every fibre of my being, I despise how the Premier League in modern football is about money and who has more money. Because if the billionaires walked away tomorrow and all we were left is with a bunch of men and women kicking a ball around a pitch, we would still love it because it's football and that's what we enjoy. And it just feels like football's been corrupted by all of this, and it's football's great and it would be great to talk about it, but instead we have to sort of talk about everything else around it and how horrible that is.
No, that's absolutely right. It's gone so far beyond, hasn't it, that this is where we've ended up. I mean, Stephen, if this was Liverpool, I mean, this is the hard thing to do, you know, it's not that easy to put yourself in the position when the reality is that isn't happening. If this was Liverpool, would you be able to, as someone who is a season ticket holder, turn your back?
Great question. And you know, it's one that several of us have you know, said over the last few days, is that, you know, until it's your own, you don't really know what your reaction would be. You know, fan power, you know, has moved mountains before, and you know, especially it's my own team, but especially Liverpool fans have managed to mobilise over the years several times to kind of like down certain political movements, or you know, stop controversial potential incidents happening. But I'll go back to the fact that not everyone's pulling in the same direction when it comes to football fandom. It's very rare that you get a collection. You know, you only have to look at something like Brexit and just how divided, you know, the ethos of so many people are, especially in this nation. You know, they don't think, you know, A, they're not thinking the same thought processes, but B, the thought process that a lot of people are coming forward with, and their ideals are so far apart that it's untrue. So, you know, honestly, you cannot truly state how your reaction would be until it happens to your club. You know, I really don't know. You know, I think anything that's happened in modern football, Paul alludes to it about, you know, I also come from that era of the Football League of being a collective 92, and you know, pre-Premier League and pre-Champions League. And, you know, the way that football changes, and the way things have revolved around my team, is that I've always quantified it in a way of trying to narrow it down and saying it's down to the green rectangular pitch, the patch of land, and kicking an inflatable ball around, you know, to try and strip away, you know, all what is rubbish about modern football, and say it eventually boils down to ball being kicked around a pitch, you know, but eventually, you know, something so big as this, you know, this is a defining thing, you know, for any set of supporters. So for me, it's just an impossible question to answer. But, you know, I wouldn't want to be in Newcastle's position right now. That's the only thing I can come up with this, is that I'd want to be in the position, as in, you know, your team's got this great influx of funds, but I wouldn't be in the position of being owned by the people who are going to own Newcastle United.
Yeah, and that is the problem. When I've given this a bit of thought, and I think about, you know, should you walk away? But to me, it kind of comes down to, well, what is that support? And how do you define support? I mean, my support of Newcastle United, depending on how you define it, hasn't been an active one for a decade or so, at least. You know, the bonds that drew me in the first place have been massively frayed over the years. I don't watch the team. I've only on occasion been to games. I don't subscribe to any of the TV channels that they're on that would allow me to watch them. I'm happy to watch other football away from the so-called elite, or immerse myself in more international stuff, which appeals more to me than the top end of the Premier League, if I'm brutally honest. I find it more satisfying. However, I always look for their results. I always hope they do well without actively participating in any meaningful way, financial or otherwise. So have I, in effect, already walked away? I mean, that's one aspect to that as well. I mean, a lot of that is to do with the Ashley regime. A lot of it's probably just to do with the age I am in life, and I've got other priorities. The only exception to this is having taken my young son to a couple of matches to introduce him to the game in the flesh. And Will that change now? No, I don't think that will, because I don't want to deny him, for one thing, and my daughter as well. The bond remains in that Newcastle is the only club I've ever had proper belonging to. You know, I can appreciate and watch others, but I don't have that pull. It's the city I grew up in. It's at its heart. But that's worlds away from active support. Now, yeah, will I still take my son from time to time? Yep, undoubtedly. Will I become an active supporter filling their coffers with my cash regularly? No, I won't. But as I say, that's no change in my circumstance. So, yes, the emotional bond has been frayed, but it does remain. What I'm questioning myself now, though, because easily I can sort of say to myself, well, that's me justifying my participation and my support, because it wasn't that active anyway. I don't pay the club money. So I'm not contributing financially to the Saudi wealth now, I guess, is one way of looking at it. What will happen, though, in, say, 5 or 10 years' time, Newcastle are facing off with Man City or Liverpool or Chelsea or whoever for the league title? Could happen. Will I be hoping they win? Will I be hoping Newcastle lift a trophy? Deep down, yes, I probably will. I can't erase decades of my life of interest in Newcastle just like that. Will I find fulfillment in it, though? Probably not. And that is quite sad, I think. And that's the situation I'm left in. On the one hand, suddenly there is hope in sporting terms where for so long there hadn't been any. Newcastle had ceased to be a sporting entity for several years. They willfully, deliberately, and statedly did not wish to compete beyond trying to stave off relegation. And by compete, I don't mean for trophies. I mean simply trying to better themselves. But yeah, that's the position I'm left in. I can seek to justify it a little bit to myself in that way, that I wasn't fully part of it anyway. And I'll probably remain similar. But any success that may or may not come Newcastle's way will feel, it won't feel like it would have done if we'd won in 96 under Keegan. Let's put it that way. It won't feel quite like that. What I want to come to next, though, is where the ire for this situation should go. To me, the Premier League are the ones who need to be answering the questions on this, rather than Newcastle as a club or a fan base, because it's the Premier League that have suddenly waved through what seemed to be crashing against the rocks before. No coincidence that as soon as beIN Sports were granted the right to televise in Saudi Arabia, that 48 hours later, the sale has gone through. The Premier League, they only issued one brief statement, didn't really say much, didn't address those issues, other than to say that they'd had legally binding assurance that the PIF was not in the control of the Saudi state. Matthew has talked about that part of it already, and I'm fully in agreement with what he says.
It's a good line, isn't it?
It is, yeah, it is. I do wonder what's in this legally binding statement, but I guess we'll never know. But Paul, should the Premier League be made to be, or somehow, or argued to be more open in what has gone on and what has actually caused them to wave this deal through now?
Well, I think the simple answer to that is yes. I think, you know, we kind of referenced that before, that, you know, there needs to be certainly more openness from the Premier League authorities to give some insight into the workings behind the decision-making process, how such decisions come about. I mean, without linking this to the ESL too much, I'd also would love to know the process behind the ESL decision as well, and what kind of therefore process were set that legal. But I think the bottom line it comes down to, you know, we have to accept that these days the modern Premier League, as Matthew and Steve above indicates there, it's all about money, sadly, and the money, the level of money and how you invest it determines the level of success you achieve. But the more money you have initially, straight away you're putting yourself in contention for honours, which is probably denied for 2/3 of the club in the Premier League. So what I would say is that I think it's sometimes hard to accept that the Premier League is run by a cabal of moneymakers whose main interest is to see how much they can get out of the fans, how much they can get from the TV deal, how much they can squeeze out the sponsors, how much more money they can put in their coffers. And at the same time, how do they then establish themselves as figures of respectability in society by their ownership of Premier League clubs? And to me, that's kind of the fundamental issue here. Anyone who grew up watching football in the 70s and 80s could not even begin to imagine how football has turned out now in this century of the Premier League, and the overall emphasis on squeezing the fans at every last penny to make the coffers overflow and overflow even more, using tax dodges to avoid paying your correct provisions the government, etc. So yeah, it's a really frustrating situation at the moment. There's no question that if Tracy Couch has any clout about her and any true power in the brief that she's been given, then there certainly should be some sort of independent monitoring of the Premier League, and sort of independent adjudicator of the Premier League, someone who would actually stand up and make the clubs answer for the decisions that they've made. Because at the moment, the government's attitude very much seems to be, well, we don't interfere in the business. It's a Premier League decision, which is a nice, easy cop-out, really, to make. But I definitely think that there does need to be some greater government involvement of the running of the Premier League, and to assess the impact on the fans, and not just the impact on the fans. I wonder about the impact on society as well, and the impact on the younger generation of kids coming through when they're kind of growing up, where they're used to states with a hugely debatable human rights record, just being able to walk in and buy a Premier League club, and there's no questions asked. I just don't think that situation is tolerable anymore.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, you kind of wonder what next, don't you? Where does it go after this?
Wait, do you think what next? Because I guess the plan for Newcastle is that when ESL resurfaces again, Newcastle are going to be contenders for us. I'd argue as well that if the Saudi Arabia take over had happened 18 months earlier, Newcastle would have been one of the clubs approached to be an ESL club. I think there's no question about that. You know, I hate to use the words of Michael Knighton when he took over Carlisle United. He described the prospect of it's brilliant because it's a sole franchise. Given where you are in the north of England, Newcastle United basically is a sole franchise. Sorry, Southern fans, but that's the truth. And at the moment, it's from a business point of view, to buy Newcastle United with its potential is a really, really clever move, because you just know you'll have 60, 70,000 fans there every pack on the stage amount, and it's an absolute sensible decision if you want to take a football club that's got huge potential that has remained untapped for 50 years or so.
Well, exactly, and Mike Ashley proved utterly unfit to tap into that resource and then decided he didn't want to because it would cost him then. But you're right, the potential, if we're talking football terms and owner terms, is huge. This is another stratosphere of what anyone may have imagined, though, of course. Matthew, for you on this, is we talked how this, I guess, is a sort of natural extension of the endless lust for money, the endless greed. Now, as we said, this isn't just a football thing, but it's this country, a bit of a sick nation in many ways. Unfortunately, we're happy to deal with anyone if the price is right, up to a point, I guess, but that point is very far off. I guess there's only North Korea that are beyond that point, possibly. London was this week described as the money laundering capital of the world, which tells you a lot. The government panders to Saudi Arabian wealth. We deal with arms, of course, to Saudi Arabia. The Queen does her part by wining and dining the Saudi princes. We as consumers, then, we feed this endless lust for greed, I guess, in so many areas. And the Premier League is just the same. It's one of these, but it's born of this background, this situation, I guess. The lust for money trumps all. It's created a situation where the only way to compete is to throw away your morals and join the mega wealthy. So now that we've hit this point, does this damage the Premier League? Is the image tainted now? Maybe not beyond repair, but temporarily. Or is that almost impossible to do so as long as the football is good and more top players come?
I mean, first, that was a hilariously depressing list of things to read out. Like, that's terrifying.
Yeah.
I think the Premier League, it's difficult to put into words, but I think all the Premier League is already broken, because you can't go from having this much money to having no money. So there's no way of backtracking from this, unless for it to go catastrophically wrong at some point in the future. Because it's like you said, what comes next? Who is richer than Saudi Arabia? Who is left now to continue to hoover up the clubs and to continue to buy and conduct this like world global transparent sports washing of clubs? The only thing I can see that comes next is turning the Premier League into the European or the worldwide Super League. You know, like, I think it's one of the aspects of what I found quite like depressingly. You know, when we had those videos of the Newcastle fans outside of St. James's Park and they were chanting and singing, saying, "We've got our club back." Like, the club has never been so far away of being theirs. Like, everything you listed earlier of what it is you enjoyed about being a Newcastle fan, you know, or for me, like being a Birmingham City fan, it's about family. It's about my dad and my brother. We go to the football, we spend time together. We've been terrible for the last decade, so there's no enjoyment we get from watching the sport, really. But it's about the connections. It's about being part of, you know, 20,000 other people who think the way that you do and like love the same thing that you do. And that's why I guess it hurts so much when it's not that you're not consulted. It's just that this thing is swept out from under your feet and you are given no choice about it. But you're plunked straight down in the middle of this moral discussion where it's an impossible conversation to have with yourself, let alone with other people. So. And then how do you even begin to look at what comes next? Maybe the game will be divided up, you know, with the discussions of the European Super League and the Juventus chairman. I've forgotten his name already. But when he was talking about monetizing different parts of the game, you know, like, because apparently kids don't like football anymore, so they're going to be more interested in watching the last 15 minutes of games. So I could just... whatever hasn't been monetized yet will continue to be monetized until the entire thing collapses in on itself. I think I can't see how, you know, I can't see what else happens next. Just more money until it goes bust.
Yeah, it's quite a depressing thought, isn't it? But yeah, incredible. I think exactly. The only way next from this kind of level is another nation of similar wealth, I guess, or, as you say, the game changing utterly and it becomes some sort of Super League, World League or whatever.
I do think there's something really ironic about everything that's happening with the Premier League right now in comparison to what we've mentioned already, Brexit, in that Brexit, we've attempted to become insular and cut off from the rest of the world, and yet we have this product in the Premier League that is like the wet dream of Thatcherism and what every sort of capitalist Tory would love to see, in that, you know, it is a worldwide bank of, you know, expenditure, and it's hilarious and quite morbidly interesting to see how that is in direct comparison with how, you know, the state of the country as it is at the minute, which is, you know, another strand to add to the depression.
Just throw that one in the mix as well.
It kind of reminds me of that sketch in Monty Python. I think is The Meaning of Life, Mr. Creosote, and you know, he just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. You know, it's just whether or not football will explode in that manner or not. You know, but what it is it's just constantly inflating the game in some description. And yeah, we've always talked of the potential for the bubble to burst, but it doesn't show any signs of doing so. You know, the wider span of football, perhaps, you know, it works as a slow puncher. You know, the biggest get bigger, the rest, you know, struggle to hang on. We're looking at clubs, you know, any football club, the death of a football club is absolutely huge, from the smallest, you know, way down to the smallest. The loss of Bury size absolutely should be seismic for all of football. We're looking at Derby County dicing with death, you know, and you got clubs like that who are chasing the dream of being involved in what's unfolding in the Premier League. You know, the Premier League's only going to get smaller in terms of teams, bigger in terms of, you know, monetary inflation. You know, it's it's just such a cash cow. It's unbelievable. You know, it's frightening, really. You know, it's the only way to do it. And we're all guilty of putting the blinkers on and just trying to condense football into its most, you know, base and base attractive terms. You know, we, like Matthew's just mentioned there about family. You know, Paul's nodded away, and so have I. Because, you know, football, I say it many times, it's me going with my dad, you know, and savouring each game, and, you know, while he's still with us. So, you know, in a way, football exploits us all in that respect, because we are that generation. You know, Matthew said, you know, kids don't want to watch a full match. They want to watch the last 15 minutes. You know, Paul mentioned early on about being of that first division generation, of that Football League generation. You know, there's no way in the world I would be attracted to football now if I was coming into it right now at this minute, looking for something to occupy so much of my life. I wouldn't choose football. You know, I'm hooked on football because of what it was. You know, I've often referred to Liverpool, you know, at its worst, as being that much loved family member who's turned into a bit of a dickhead. You know, and you kind of like, you know, you stick by it because you're compelled to do so, you know, by familial bonds. You know, and football across the board is exactly the same. I can't be surprised to hear that kids don't want to watch football, and that just makes this middle-aged generation that are the people who tip up at the stadiums. You know, I look at Anfield and there's teenagers and you know, who'll go to away games and stuff like that. You go into Anfield on a match day, it's the majority people in the 40s, 50s, 60s and more. You know, this is why, you know, Matthew's right, is that, you know, the revenue strands next will be how to hook a younger generation in, and, you know, what that will be, you know, charging through the nose to watch the last 10, 15 minutes of a football match, or, you know, whatever manner that is, you know, VR headsets and all sorts, and being sat in stadiums. The BBC did that for a World Cup a few years ago. You know, my lad's got a VR set. I sat and watched a game or two with his VR set on just for the morbid curiosity of it. And he thought, this is what people will do. You know, it's I don't know, football, but, you know, it's kind of as if it's written by George Orwell.
I want to add, because just the thing of that is that, do you remember, like, during the European Super League thing, Florentino Perez was listing off, you know, this whole thing about kids don't want to watch football, when he was totally misrepresenting the facts. Like, the facts, the statistics that he had stated that football has never been more popular. Kids love football. It's just that we're priced out. Well, say we, sorry, I'm 28 and counting myself as a kid, but people are priced out of it. I know, like, I support Birmingham City, and there was some big outrage at the start of the season where the club, I mean, I don't know if anybody is aware, but half of our stadium is closed at the minute.
Yeah. You've got two sides closed, haven't you, Matthew?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And yet they are completely, like, fucking over the fans massively. It's an outrage. It's atrocious. And yet they are still charging, like, kids 20, 25, 30 pounds to attend games. Kids can't afford that. We can't, like, people can't afford that. I can barely afford that. And I'm in a really well-paid job. Fairly well-paid job. It's the constant drive for monetization, the constant drive for money in the sport is what is driving people away, I think, because people just can't afford it. You have to rely on, you know, watching it on TV, because that's all you can afford to do.
Is there a tipping point to this, though?
Eight nights coming there for a second. Just to develop what Matthew and Stephen were saying there as well. I think you brought me two excellent points there. As Stephen points out, quite often now, I mean, the age profile of the average Premier League fan, I guess, is about 45, 46 now. And if you can look at old photographs of football crowds in the 60s and 70s, they're predominantly under 30. So there's been a real generational shift there. You actually pay to go watch a football match. Secondly, as Matthew said there as well, the younger element is being priced out of going to watch football. And is that because clubs are thinking, well, there might be other ways to get money from these people rather than them actually attending the match? I don't know. And just to link up to what you're saying, the other massive thing that concerns me now is this all-pervasive feeling that whenever I watch a football match, I've got to put a bet on, because I just cannot escape being told to bet you on a football match. And I just find that morally injustifiable.
Is there a tipping point to all of this now, on a number of financial issues you're talking about there, but perhaps in terms of the owners, is this potentially a tipping point? You know, we talked how the owners test, well, what kind of test is that if the state of Saudi Arabia can pass it? Well, the simple reason is it passed because the owners test doesn't care about human rights, good or otherwise. It doesn't check that. Maybe that will change off the back of this. Who knows? Or is the fact that TV deals and piracy were clearly the main blocker or the only blocker to this deal in the first place? Does that mean that nobody in the Premier League cares as long as the money comes in? Will there be a tipping point? Question to anybody willing to answer it.
you feel that there kind of has to be, but whatever that looks like is sort of unfathomable to think about, because it's like we said, like the game has gotten to a point now where it can't exist without that money, and yet it does feel that at some point the game will explode. Like, we have clubs going out of business, we have people not being able to afford. We just come through the back. We're still in the middle of a pandemic. Like, people can't afford to keep spending money on football because people don't have any money. Like, it's one of those things where if you look across the wider societal aspect of it, like the average wage for people aged 20, what are they earning? What can they afford to spend their money on? It's not football. So there kind of has to be at some point, and it kind of has to be at some point, and like an explosion, whatever it looks like, though. I think we can't imagine it.
Indeed. Paul, any thoughts?
Well, I think, you know, I think we all have huge concerns about the future of football. You know, I've kind of come around to accept that maybe, you know, within about 20, 30 years' time, we're going to have a World Football League with like 50% of the teams from the United States being part of it as well. And then us poor teams left behind in England will be part of like a world regional division where, you know, with a bit of luck and if we have the right backers and if we satisfy certain impossibly to meet criteria, we might stand a chance of one season playing in the World Football League. So it is quite a depressing scenario, I think, as well. And on the other hand, you could take the viewpoint that, you know, you look at the example of FC United, you know, the fans who set up their own club as opposed to against the Glazers, and are still functioning almost 10 years since we first set up and got their own ground stage, and now and the tennis are held up really well. You also look at the returns to the Football League of Wimbledon of the fans having brought the club back up again as well. And there are a few examples of smaller clubs being taken over by fan groups and getting themselves back into the Football League. So, you know, it's always a dangerous business to predict the future, as we all know. But, you know, society changes, attitudes change, morals change. So who knows where we're going to be in 30 years' time. But I just hope we're not in a situation where the way the Premier League is going now just seems to be going in unchallenged. And really, for the benefit of football and the future generation of football fans coming through, something needs to change.
Well, speaking of change and the future, shall we move on from this topic then? Let's move away from this thorny issue and get into a different thorny issue. Arsene Wenger, FIFA's Arsene Wenger now. He's come out with recent plans. The headline grabbing fact in amongst there is his plans for a biennial World Cup every 2 years. I guess cluttering up the schedule and ever expanding. But there were some other ideas in there. You know, his whole gist was about not playing more games, but to play more big games. He seems convinced his plans will be good for football, good for clubs, good for international teams. He's looking overall at the international calendar, repeated international breaks, of which we're in the midst of one right now. And I'm speaking as a lover of the international game. This is where my sort of, having been put off the elite club game, this is where my attentions have been drawn to international aspects, not England necessarily, but all over. You know, it's international breaks frustrate, especially in September, October, when Premier League's getting going. Plans intended to have a simpler, more modern way of organising the calendar, reduce the number of qualifiers, reduce the number of international windows, play things in one or two blocks only. I guess, firstly, Stephen, on that is ignoring the biennial World Cup aspect for the moment. Is the current model of the international calendar unsustainable or unfit for the modern game?
I'd say it's unfit. Unsustainable is another matter, because these things can just drag on and on. You know, once something's been set in stone, then it can take generations, you know, for things to shift. And notoriously, you know, people in football, supporters, you know, don't like change. You know, a lot of them, a lot of administrators don't like change. As far as kind of like condensing international breaks are concerned, I actually agree with that. You know, I think having a 2-week international break in September, October and November, you know, I just don't think it's for the best of the players, you know, let alone anyone else. You know, it breaks up the fluidity of the club game, you know, and within that, I don't think it does the international game all that many favours either. I remember having an argument not so long ago, or a heated debate, shall we say, not so long ago about, you know, I'd suggested that the international season needed, the international game needed a season of its own rather than these punctuated international breaks. You know, an international tournament lasts for a month. You know, how is, you know, 8 to 9 or 10 days for an international manager with players that might not necessarily be able to be called up because of mystery injuries, representative of how a tournament football will be? You know, for me, I'd say I've 1 or 2 international windows in a season, but elongate them. I have to have them at 3 or 4 weeks. You know, play a job lot of qualifiers all in one go. You know, play half of the qualifiers in one sitting. And I think, you know, people will be a lot more interested. I like the idea of you know, less qualifiers in terms. One of the big sticking points for me, I mean, I'm a fan of the international game. Doesn't sound like it, but I am. You know, I like competitive international football. You know, do away with the Nations League. It's, again, it's another one that's been thrown into there. And it's more and more and more football. It's ludicrous. We only have to look at Christian Eriksen, who's lucky to be alive now. You know, we've got to get more instances of players collapsing on football pitches because of you know, physical issues or even exhaustion. You know, it's something you can't keep on prodding players to play and then getting them to move from, you know, to do the travel involved as well in international break. You know, it just doesn't make common sense as far as I'm concerned. If you were drawing the boundaries now, if you were drawing a landscape now to say, here is a sport we've invented here today, would you draw up the football calendar the way it is?
I think it's safe to say no. And that brings in the question, of course, of if World Cups hadn't been every 4 years all along, if they'd been every 2 years and someone was proposing switching it to every 4, we'd probably all be aghast at that, which is an interesting thought, I suppose. Paul, on this, if Wenger's plans didn't include more frequent World Cups, would they be viewed quite favourably for a lot of the reasons Stephen's going into there?
Well, I still think there's a fair amount of support for Wenger's World Cup plans, Aidan, because I think we're all agreed, that, you know, both in this group and outside, that the current international calendar is just an absolute mess with far, far, far too many meaningless games. I mean, I'd love to know what the viewing figures were for Andorra England last night, because although I like watching international football, I've just no interest in watching games like that. I think he's right. I mean, except that, you know, as a manager, Wenger was quite an innovator, so I always have time for his opinions because I think he's a deep thinker about the game. And he I don't think he's a type of person just to come up with a solution because he's just thought so on the back of an envelope. So I think he's given this a lot of thoughts as well. As I said, initially, as a legacy football fan, I had concerns about the 4-year a 2-year World Cup. But looking at it again, I'm a bit more open and receptive to it because, as we were outlined, I hate the way the international breaks disrupt the Premier League season. To me, the Premier League doesn't get going to mid-November because then you've got about a 4-month gap until the next break in March. To me, that's when the season really starts. And I just don't like the stop-start approach to domestic season. I think as well, I've always been... There's too many meaningless games, as I've outlined before, and I know there's an argument for trying to get more of the lesser nations involved, to give them more opportunities to participate, which I agree with. I also like the idea of every 2 years World Cup because, you know, there's not been a World Cup in England since 1966. You know, if it stays at every 4 years now, probably the earliest we're going to get another one is sort of mid-2030s maybe. So I just think for younger generation fans growing up, to have a World Cup every 2 years, at least raise the possibility of England maybe getting one before 2030. Because if for argument's sake, you know, you were born after 1966, then that's been like 55 years or so when there's been no major World Cup competition in the home of football, which to me just seems ludicrous. And I've always often wondered about this because I don't understand the point of group games and World Cup qualifiers. I just see it as another way of getting money, sponsorship, generating revenue. I mean, why not just go the whole hog and have a knockout competition? You know, and have the draw with the draw. So in the first round, it could be Holland against Belgium. On the other hand, it could be Holland against Andorra. You don't know what the draw is going to be. And then you progress through each round. So the level of intensity increases each round. And then you get through to a final four who qualify for the World Cup. Because I just think the current model doesn't work for me. I watch about 10% of England's game when they have that one match against a team who might actually score a goal against them but not beat them. And I know it might be different if you're a fan of Scotland and Wales, and I appreciate for the smaller nations, the international competition is really much more meaningful. I've got friends in Belfast who love international football, love watching Northern Ireland, and I totally get that. But for me as an England fan, I just find the mismatch of so many games that we play in, inevitably is an overinflated sense of how good we are that often comes undone in major competitions. So the more I thought about it, the more I'm warm to the idea of a World Cup every 2 years. And if I'm given the choice of an extra Nations League competition or a World Cup competition, then to me, it's got to be the World Cup.
On the qualifiers thing, Paul, that's an interesting point because, as you say, World Cup qualifiers are frequently meaningless in Europe because of the disparity in quality. But that's a very European view, a European situation, that it's weak and uncompetitive. That's not so in the rest of the world. You know, reducing qualifiers sounds great for Europe, absolutely, but terrible for, say, South America, where the strength of the teams has come from the marathon qualifying process, whereas previously some countries went years without playing a competitive game. I think that would be similar in other parts of the world where smaller nations, they don't get many opportunities for proper competitive games against teams at their level. And the lengthier qualifying processes allow that. So, yeah, I guess, and that's where a lot of the votes, of course, will come from whenever FIFA consider something.
And just going on that as well, I mean, I'm always quite fascinated by the example of Australia choosing to join the Asian Federation instead of the Oceania Federation, because I think that's a real body blow to Oceania not having Australia representing that continent and joining Asia, because I think the level of football is more difficult for them. I just think, you know, you've got like a part of the Southern Hemisphere there that's got very, very little chance in the near future of being represented in the World Cup. And if you're all about expanding the world game, I think that needs to be looked at.
Well, looking at the headline grabbing item then, Matthew, obviously that is the biennial World Cup. Now, there was a joint statement from UEFA and several European FAs, including England's, on the impact that this proposal would have, not just the men's World Cup, but women's World Cup as well. Wenger and FIFA claim this would allow, as Paul's talking about there, more opportunity to be there for more nations and for more players. He doesn't feel, though, it would diminish, if I can say it, the tournament's prestige. Can that be true?
I think maybe I'm the one that disagrees with Stephen Ball in that. I like Wenger. I think he's an interesting man and a great manager, but I kind of hated everything he said. I don't think there was anything that I really agreed with. Because, I mean, not only because I think they're so transparently just trying to make more money from the thing. Like, I found out some statistics. So FIFA made a $4.8 billion profit on the 2014 World Cup. They didn't put any money into it. They had zero investment, but they made $4.8 million. That figure went up to, in 2018, to $5.6 billion. So it's kind of easy to see why they suggested two years, not every 3 years, and why they would want the World Cup to happen more frequently. Then I think, lawyers, what I do agree with is the bit about the calendar is insane, because not only they're trying to fit in like this World Cup every 2 years, they're trying to bump up the Club World Cup to, like, was it a 48 team or was it 38 team? I've forgotten now. But that is crazy. Like, this we're asking far too much of footballers as it is. Using Eriksen as an example, I think is fair, because we're asking too much of these players. I think Marcus Rashford and Kevin De Bruyne were talking about how basically the last year of football they've both been playing with painkillers every week because they've been injured and they've just been sort of forcing themselves to play through. So how often are we actually seeing these world-class players play to the full potential, then I think the World Cup is football in its most purest form, because there's no financial doping, you can't cheat the system. Well, I guess you can cheat the system, but it's rare that you can cheat the system to get the world's best players to come and play for your nation, because that's you can't change people's nationality like that. To me, the World Cup is football in its purest form. It is fun, it is amazing, and the fact that it is every 4 years is an element of what makes it so special. Moving it to every 2 years, I think, is asking too much of players, and it's kind of impossible, especially when you consider stuff like the African Cup of Nations. There's a reason why they have that every 2 years, because it is such an audience grabber for African nations, and it's a chance for them to compete and to win something. And the winners change quite regularly, so that's important for them as a nation, I can't think of the right word, but as a continent, is important for them to have that. So I think it's something that doesn't really have any positives for me anyway. I think I can't see any sort of positives in it, and would just dilute the World Cup and make it far less special. I mean, you can't just say, like Wenger can't just say we should have more important games, because half the time the meaningless games are what make the important games important. You can't just keep throwing these important games together and say this one's important. It doesn't really work like that, I don't think.
Yeah, to jump in there, I'd say what they need to look at is, rather than more football, just try to make what already exists more meaningful. You know, the qualifiers are virtually unwatchable as far as the European side of it is. I fully agree with what Paul said. You know, the more that a major tournament inflates in the numbers of teams who are taking part, the less credible the qualifiers become, because they're a foregone conclusion. They're not attractive. You know, I remember kind of like sitting watching England play Poland on a knife edge and stuff like that. You know, having to go to Poland to get a point to qualify for the 1990 World Cup. There is no kind of like knife edge, element to qualifiers anymore. If they wanted to do something like, you know, a biennial World Cup, which is for me, not the idea to go down. Have a 2 year gap between, the men's and the women's World Cup. You know, every 2 years, you know, give the women's World Cup the true big up that it needs. You know, the next, 2022. You know, have the women's World Cup 2024 and give it the full panoramic view and say, here we are, here's your summer World Cup, which, you know, and play it. You know, if the European Championships are to land in June to July, then play the Women's World Cup July to August before the club season all kicks off again. As far as the men's game's concerned, you know, give us a summer of full football, every 2 years, with the Men's World Cup 2 years later. You know, be you know, a little bit more, I don't know, they could be a lot cleverer than they're currently willing or capable of being.
I think that's a key point. Sorry, Matthew, about the impact on the women's game. Obviously, if the men's World Cup is more frequent, the exposure for the women's version is reduced, because what happens in between each men's World Cup? Well, I guess there's some sort of squeezing of the continental championships. Also, maybe the Euros has to find a place there. But
it kind of works. Look at the Olympics, where they schismed the Olympics, didn't they? The Summer and the Winter Olympics used to take place in the same year. You know, and they split it. You know, there's a 2 year gap. So, you know, the Summer Olympics were this year should have been last year. The Winter Olympics would be next year. You know, it would work on that kind of system. You know, you kind of get in a World Cup every 2 years. It just alternates between the men's and the women's. But
yeah, absolutely. But of course, Matthew was right there talking about the money, which is very much on theme with the evening. FIFA's income obviously comes from the World Cup. More than anything else, to give them a little bit of credit, I guess it does fund various programs across the world in developing nations and so on, all very worthy. But, you know, at what cost? They're sending envious glances UEFA's way, I imagine, where UEFA don't have just the Euros for their income. Obviously, there's the annual Champions League, which brings in all sorts of money. So where do FIFA go? They go to more World Cups and they go to an expanded Club World Cup. But where everything else fits in amongst that is a whole other question of, does this destroy the Euros' importance or the Copa America or the African Cup of Nations and so on, how would they all be impacted? I think there's so many strands to it, whereas FIFA are looking at the money and the votes, of course. It was ever thus. Sorry, Matthew, I jumped in ahead of you there.
It's fine. I think there are maybe more arguments for the Women's Football World Cup to be held every 2 years. But again, that kind of, I'm very, very conscious that, like, as a man talking about that, about the women's game, comes across kind of condescending. But I think there are maybe some more arguments to have that version every 2 years, as it's sort of a bigger spotlight away from the men's sport, and sort of a chance to celebrate the women's game as we should do on a par with the men's sport.
Indeed. Well, we'll see what comes of it all. No doubt all sorts of murky deals will end up going on somewhere behind the scenes to see what our future World Cup plans will be. But we'll move on to our final item now, which is any other business. Chance for the guys to throw up some other issues, maybe some more lighthearted ones, perhaps, or maybe some more bits of depression. So, Paul, how about you first?
Yeah, I'll try and do my customary one good, one bad, if that's okay. So I think I've never been a fan of Robbie Savage until the last 12 months or so, when he drew Tottenham to play Marine in the FA Cup. I thought nobody else but him could have done that. And my perception of it has always changed since then. And the more and more I read about what he's done to Macclesfield Town this season, in terms of, I mean, Stephen mentioned before, about towns losing their football clubs, like they quote Bury as an example, and for Macclesfield to lost their football club was a massive blow to that town as well. And he's rebuilt the club in the North West Counties, Division One, I think it is. They get an average gate of £3,000. He sets up a community football program. He also, during the COVID lockdown, was quite adamant and taking on the government that playing competitive sports should be brought back in far earlier than what was anticipated. So I think quietly behind the scenes, without getting the same level of publicity as other people have done, he's done a really, really good job there. And I would never have said this 15 months ago, but I'm becoming a Robbie Savage fan. I'm going to see my doctor on Monday, see what he can advise for me. But yeah, it's a total bald face there. But yeah, credit to the guy. I think he's done a really good job with the publicity.
I think you need to check your sugar levels there.
Oh, something definitely. They're going through the roof at the moment, yeah. And the bad thing is, it's quite a bugbear of mine, this, right? Because having, you know, been a school teacher for most of my life, I'm always, you know, really conscious of the effect that bullying has on kids. You know, both on kids and on members of staff are being bullied as well. It's something that stays with you for life. And it really annoys you when commentators talk about forwards bullying the centre-half, bullying the defenders, bullying the defence. And so it's a really good quality to have. And I just think it has a whole new nuance to that word that I don't associate bullying with anything good. I don't associate bullying with being a quality. And I fail to see why football commentators think to use the phrase "he's being bullied by the centre forward" is an acceptable thing to say.
Interesting point. Oh, that's a really good one to get your perspective on there. Excellent stuff. Right, Stephen, how about you?
I'll go for the heartwarming story of Stade Rennes defeating PSG the other week. You know, it's that riposte to kind of like the big bag monetary, you know, monster in the room. You know, at a time when kind of like PSG's response to Lille winning the title last year seemed to be set to win all 38 league games this season, I'm just quite pleased that, you know, I don't know, they got a bit of a slap in the face.
Well, yes, down with these clubs run by states. Excellent. And Matthew, how about you?
Yeah, this is not a cheerful one, sorry. This is not cheerful, but I think it's just really important. So on Thursday, in the 6th minute of a game between New Jersey, New York, Gotham FC and the Washington Spirit in the National Women's Soccer League in America, they paused play for a few minutes while players of both teams, including substitutes, sort of formed a circle in the middle of the pitch while the crowd cheered them. It was a really powerful image of both teams arm in arm in solidarity in response to a number of really shocking allegations that have rocked the women's football game this week. In a report by The Athletic, Sinead Farrelly and Meliana Shim accused the now sacked North Carolina Courage coach Paul Riley of sexual assault, with some really horrible, some really harrowing allegations. With the support of Alex Morgan of the US national team, they appeared on a talk show to talk about these allegations. And it's kind of, since then, it's turned into a kind of movement. Recently retired Australia forward Lisa Devanna stepped forward to talk about her experience with sexual abuse in the game, which started when she was 17. And so did Venezuelan forward Dana Castellanos, with the entire Venezuelan national team, came out and talked about how they had suffered abuse by Kenneth Zeramata. Football Australia is working with sort of other authorities in the country to independently investigate the Lisa Devanna's allegations. And Venezuela FA shared a message of solidarity with their sort of women footballers on social media, but didn't announce any investigation. So I won't go into too much details about the allegations because it's really harrowing, but it's been a shocking week for women's football and where we really should be talking about how good the WSL has been this season. We should be talking about how good the WSL has been this season. We should sort of highlight stuff like this. I know it's not fun. And we should be talking about women's football on the same level as men's, not just focusing on scandals. But I think we have a platform here to talk about this sort of stuff. And as we've sort of touched on today, football is about more than the industry, more than the sport itself. It's about people. So women's football is growing and we should be supporting that. We should help improve the game because that helps improve the quality of their work conditions. That allows people to sort of step up and give them the freedom to speak about important issues such as this. I think it's important to highlight stuff like this to show our support for the victims and for the women's game.
Absolutely. And you're right. It was a very, very powerful image. I mean, it's done the rounds on all the social media. It's become a very much a trending image, but a powerful message too. One that was repeated not quite exact circumstances, but similar circumstances today in a WSL match, I believe. Potentially, it's a bit of a Me Too type of a moment, you know, galvanizing behind obviously what has been an awful situation.
Yeah. I mean,
to hopefully produce a positive way forward from there.
Yeah, I mean, it was great to see the sort of, I think it was a few games in WSL today where they did the show of solidarity. And I mean, the images from the game in America on Thursday were really powerful, and especially to see all the crowd as well supporting and cheering the players while they did that. It was very powerful.
Absolutely. Well, thank you guys for today. We'll wrap it up there. But it's been, all the Newcastle talk anyway has been rather therapeutic for me in some ways as I deal with my inner turmoil and tear myself apart emotionally. But we'll see where we end up and we'll see where it all ends up in due course. But thanks very much for today. Cheers, Stephen, for all your contributions.
Oh, thanks for the invite, Aidan. A joy as always.
Spot on. And you, Paul, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on the show again, Aidan. It's always great to listen to Matthew and Steve and your insights as well. I mean, we feel your pain, your moral dilemma as a Newcastle fan, and this is always going to run and run, isn't it?
Oh, it sure is, yes. We'll see how it all goes. Thank you very much, Matthew.
Cheers. Thanks very much for having me on. And yeah, to echo Paul, feel the pain. Couldn't imagine being in the same situation.
Yes, we're not used to prospective success. That's the bit I can't deal with. No, that's not true. I'm being facetious. That's not true at all. Okay, well, thank you to our listeners too. We hope you join us again on all the other These Football Times podcasts and on today's Football Times. Thank you very much and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.